Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Kerry Bales is part of something called Homes for All here in Bristol, and she's also on Hartcliffe and Withywood Neighbourhood Partnership. And Sonia Morn is back, the pro-Trump supporter before the election, not so much now. Is World War III inevitable, she asks, like World War I and World War II? Have they been deliberately set up? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. And I'll give full contact details for us at the end of the show. Well, I'm joined by Kerry Bales. Kerry's from Withywood Hartcliffe Neighbourhood Partnership. What do you actually... Okay, let's start at the beginning. What is a neighbourhood partnership? We keep hearing about these things going on around Bristol.
Well, they're supposed to be the council, the councillors and the communities working together to sort local issues, to decide where the money's spent. And a lot of the time it's arguments over where flowers should be planted and road markings and things like that, but there, it is a bit more interesting than that. You do get to have your say.
So how long have you been doing that for, Kerry?
We had an election, I think it was in October, but I went to quite a lot of meetings before that for about a year, I'd say. And then we had elections in October and three were elected, all women. I came first, Hayley Ward came second, and Lorraine Horgan came third, I think. So three resident reps in my area, Hartcliffe,
okay,
all in.
So you're a resident rep. What does that entitle you to do? What's your duties or responsibilities? But you don't get paid, do you?
No, definitely not. We were asked to pick two subjects, or three subjects, to concentrate our time on. And I chose domestic violence, antisocial behaviour, and... drugs and alcohol, because I think that's the biggest problems in our area.
Okay, take them one by one. Domestic violence.
Yeah, domestic violence is four times higher in Hartcliffe. Myself, I've been a victim of domestic violence, not once, not twice, but three times. Three times.
How did you manage that?
Well, I seem to... I don't know if it's me that attracts the wrong men or they are attracted to me, I don't know.
But how have you actually been able to deal with that then personally?
I've moved around the BS13 area quite a lot. I've had the support of my friends and family. There's been times in my life when I've had nothing. I left one ex-partner with four black bags of clothes and nothing else. My daughter had even less than that, and I had to go back to my parents and sleep on a two-seat sofa.
Have you had any support from the council?
Well, I was rehoused pretty quickly last time, but I put myself on the council list a year before I planned my exit, but the property I was put into wasn't in a good state of repair, and it took me a long time to get the repairs done. A lot of me nagging the councillors and various different people, getting letters of support. It wasn't easy.
So are you in the right space now?
I am now. I like my house now. Yes, I'm on my own, separated and now divorced from my husband. Just me and my children there.
So you're able then to help others maybe who are going through similar stuff now?
Yeah, people come to me with their, not necessarily problems, but they ask for advice, and if I can point them in the right direction or signpost them, I do.
Are there any warning signs that domestic violence might be about to get more serious?
Well, I think the cuts could cause more domestic violence. If you've got couples that are trying to pay their rent, they're going out, they're working, they're earning the money, and then it's difficult to pay your rent and council tax, you get into arrears, that's going to cause arguments, that could cause domestic violence.
Do you find that actually that happens quite a lot, where you've got something in the background that's causing that? The domestic violence in a way is a symptom of something else?
Yeah, I think a lot of it arises from debts, drug misuse, alcoholism. It could be anything really that sets it off.
So we're now moving on to your other responsibility, drugs and alcohol.
Yes.
I imagine there's a fair amount of both going around in Hartcliffe.
Yes. We have our amazing services, Hawkspring. Without that, the problem would be a million times worse. They are absolutely amazing at what they do.
Okay, so where are they and what do they do?
Hawkspring is situated opposite Morrison's in the At Symes building. They support the users themselves, they support their families, and they support the children in the primary schools. They've run sessions there. So it's not just the user that gets the help, it's the whole family, and that is why they're so successful.
Well, some people say actually people who are using hard drugs like heroin shouldn't get any help, and they actually, you know, there's a lot of other people out there that aren't using heroin that need that help.
Well, drug addiction, alcoholism, it's a disease. It's you don't ask for it to come to you. It just happens. You might try it once and you might try it 100 times, you know. And we've all got addictions, whether it be coffee, shopping, food. We've all got one addiction or another. We don't ask for it, do we?
Okay. And so are people actually able to be helped there? You know, is it to actually get off? I suppose one of the main things is people actually need some kind of purpose in life. And often the drugs are actually an expression of, well, I don't feel I've got any direction, I'm bored, etc.
Yeah, it can be that. It you know, there's not a lot in Hartcliffe. You've got no local businesses, you've got no training opportunities. You know, there is nothing. We might have lots of supermarkets and chain stores. We've got McCall's, Morrison's, we've got B&Q, we've even got a Marks and Spencer's. But there are no local businesses, you know. Nothing for the youngsters to do. If you wanted to train as a bricklayer or a scaffolder, then there's plenty of opportunity for that. But anything else, if you want a career, a bigger career in whatever direction, there is nothing.
So we've mentioned drugs and alcohol. We've talked about domestic abuse, domestic violence. What was your other?
Antisocial behaviour.
Right. I suppose that's kind of comes into both, doesn't
yes.
it, really?
Yes.
So how do you define antisocial behaviour and what can you do about it?
Well, antisocial behaviour can be anything from a fight in a pub or outside a pub. It can be kids hanging around the parks, causing a nuisance, setting fire to things. It could be lots of things.
It could be kids going up to Morrison's with a load of paint and smearing it on the windows of Morrison's, and then when they come and clear it, 5 minutes yes. later they're back again.
Yes, there has been quite a lot of antisocial behaviour. There always is in the summer, kids setting fire to bins and things, but it is on the rise. Crime in itself is on the rise in my area. People have been stealing tools from vans, even DIY SOS. We were in Hartcliffe a few weeks ago and they were a victim of crime.
So who is DIY SOS?
It's a BBC renovation programme where they help vulnerable people. It was a family that's got a disabled son and they modernised the house. They put an extension on there and did it all up so that he didn't have to stay in residential care. He could come home.
Fantastic. And even that got thievery.
Yes, it's a deprived area. It always has been. And, well, judging by the cuts, it's always going to be unless something stops now.
So has Hartcliffe been a victim of the cuts as well? Because obviously many of those services are desperately needed in Hartcliffe where they might not necessarily be elsewhere.
Yeah, our library services have been cut. That they're only open 12 hours a week. Our citizen service point has been taken away, very short notice.
Okay, hang on. A library that's only open 12 hours a week?
Yes.
Right, so is that that's maybe 2 days?
I think so, yeah. Or so many hours per day. It's you know, it's not really good enough. What are kids supposed to do? You're encouraging education. You know, and they shut the libraries.
Well, they should go on their phones, shouldn't they? Isn't that what they do nowadays?
Well, if they're on their phones, then what else are they accessing?
Also, the citizen service point. I have never had the pleasure of using a citizen service point, I don't think. Why are they important?
Because people go there to report repairs. If you have a change in your circumstances, if you're on benefits and you say you start work and you have to give the council your wage slips for your housing benefit, you can take all that there. You can go and pay your rent, your council tax.
Okay, whereabouts is that in Hartcliffe?
It's where Morrison's is. There was always a rent office there. It's been there for 10, 15 years, I think. It it's not the nicest looking building. It's a bit imposing. It used to look a bit like a prison, and then they took the took the barbed wire, so to speak, off.
Oh God!
And it was built all those years ago to keep. Well, no, it was built not long after the riots, so it's probably older than that. The riots were 25 years ago, and it was built sometime after that, and it was to keep people out, keep burglars out. It's a secure building, but it's become a bit of a hub for the community. You know, if you're going to pay your rent there, you can go in Morrison's, you go in and use the library. It is well needed. People that do work, they can't afford the bus fare to go to town. If you don't work and you've got a bit of arrears, it's basically putting our rent up by either bus fare or internet charges. I myself have had to cancel my gym membership so that I can have internet put into my home, so my physical and mental health is going to suffer. You know what? Because the payments take a week to leave your bank account, you're then again a week in arrears. So Bristol City Council are trying to take my house now because, through no fault of my own, my payment is late.
So this is all the removal of the citizen service point. When did that happen then?
The 31st of March.
Right. So everybody in Hartcliffe is in the same boat there?
Well, people come from the wider community to pay their rent there, from Knoll, Philwood, even further than that.
Not anymore, they don't.
No.
And the internet, OK, so everything is going to be online now, isn't it? I mean, isn't that
yeah,
just inevitable?
Yeah, but that excludes a massive part of the community. You know, a lot of elderly in Hartcliffe alone, it's got the lowest take-up of people having internet fitted. You know, if you can't afford to have internet fitted, you can't afford a smartphone to have credit on that phone, you know, you've got no choice but to go to Temple Street. It's ridiculous.
Now, Hartcliffe is thought of as a sort of sink estate, isn't it? It's a, you know, it was built as a kind of place for people who would be the workers of the city, certainly not the kind of luxury middle class houses, that kind of thing. Mostly rented houses, etc.
There is planning permission on the Old Woods pub site for 10 luxury 3-bed houses to be built there. It's pretty obvious they're building them there because it's so close to the Link Road. But you're going to have these well paid families living in these houses. And what is there in our area for them to do? There's no restaurants. There's only about 3 or 4 pubs. You know, what is there to do? If they want to go out and have a family day out, they're still going to have to go out of the area.
Fascinating. Well, I wonder, it'd be interesting to say hello to those people when they arrive.
I certainly can't afford to buy one of those luxury houses.
And most people can't, can they? Most people are paying rent, whether it's to a private landlord or someone that's bought their council house there in the past. The trouble is, of course, sometimes both working parents, they're not earning enough to keep going.
Well, the rent on the average 3-bed council house in my area is about £86. Some of the housing associations are anything up to £150 a week. And then, well, private landlords, they can charge what they want. A lot of them are ex-council houses in my area, which would mean it's exactly the same as a council house, and they're charging 3 or 4 times the rent. You know, that's just, it's just not fair. We don't live in a fair society.
Well, I mean, people who are paying for private rented in the city centre, around the city centre, would look with jealousy on paying something like £86 a week rent, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Well, council houses are the only affordable houses to rent if you work. If the minute you come off housing benefit in a housing association house, it becomes unaffordable. Homes for All did a case back before Christmas. Dawn Winson, she was in and out of work, so housing benefit took months and months to catch up and tell her how much she had to pay. She ended up getting in arrears. Her rent was £152. You know, if you're working, well, where does that extra money come from? It's not covered by housing benefit.
Now, this Homes for All, you're part of that as well.
Yes.
What are you doing with them?
We've just got a case come in, Natasha Warren. She lives in a 2-bed flat with her partner, her stepson, and their 3 children. It is, you'd have to see it to believe it. You've got all 4 children sharing a bedroom. Well, that it's not even a bedroom. It was a living room, but it was the biggest room in the house. So they're all in there. The wallpaper is hanging off the walls. There's damp. There's mould everywhere. It is awful. They are clean people. They both work. You shouldn't have to live in that. It's 2017. you shouldn't sharing a bedroom with your brothers and sisters is fine when you're little, but when you're a teenager, when you're studying for your GCSEs, you know, it's not acceptable.
I think this is a much bigger problem, isn't it? Is any chance you think of solving the housing crisis just in Hartcliffe?
Oh, who knows? Who knows? With a Tory government, who knows?
What would you like to see happen anyway?
I would like to see, obviously, the Tories gone. I would like to see Asher and Marvin pull their finger out. They're in negotiations with Morrison's and the DWP to put the cash machine where you pay your rent that was in the citizen service point, put in either one of those. You know, this should have been thought about back in September, October, when the decision was made. Not scrabbling round is too little too late. It should have been thought about before that. They should have had a plan. They didn't. They've let us down.
OK, so what are people in Hartcliffe and Withywood doing to make their points felt at City Hall?
They're writing to their councillors. A lot of them are complaining to me. And, you know, everywhere I go in Hartcliffe, people stop me and I like to hear their stories and they stand and chat. And it does take up quite a lot of my time, but I love it. And they're not happy. They're not happy that we elected a Labour mayor, a mayor that cares. That's what they were saying at the time. I encourage people in my area to vote for Marvin. And, well, I feel betrayed. The people of Hartcliffe feel betrayed.
Why? I mean, surely it's not his fault. He's implementing cuts from the government.
Well, the Tory government might not be giving him any money, but it was his decision to make cuts in my area. Not Tories. If it was a Tory councillor or mayor, then tell me his name and I'll go after him. I will badger him
okay.
or her.
All right, Kerry, how do people get hold of you if they've got something they want to chat to you about?
I'm on Facebook, my personal page. I've got my resident rep page. They can contact me through Homes for All. If they want to speak to me, they can go to HWCP in Hartcliffe. Lots of ways to... I'm also on Twitter.
All right, Kerry Bales from Withywood and Hartcliffe Neighbourhood Partnership and many other things as well. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Right, well, I'm joined by Sonia Morn again. Hi, Sonia. You've got a kind of admin clerical role here in Bristol. Quite a lot of training. I think it's probably quite a lot of pressure and stress during the day. Mm-hmm. But you have a lot of interest outside your job, don't you? Which is a lot to do with kind of trying to keep an eye on geopolitics.
Mm. Yeah, I have an avid interest, and particularly with the American elections. I've been following that very, very closely.
You have, and you were in here before the election. That's really, I suppose, last autumn, saying how you really thought it was important that Trump got elected.
And absolutely.
Do you still think that?
I don't think that right now. But, however, I wouldn't backtrack on my original decision. He was, and to me, the only strongest candidate there at the time. And the only reason was I thought he was the best pick out of the bunch. It was demonstrated he wasn't going to be bullied. And secondly, he had the best policies, and he really had the best policies for America, regardless of the world stage and the rest of the world.
And regardless if he actually sticks to them or not.
Well, exactly. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, he demonstrated, I think, more clearly than anyone else that he had a better track record than, say, his clear opposition, which is Hillary Clinton, who clearly has had a lot of trouble with her past and criminal dealings, with which would otherwise be criminal dealings.
Okay, but can you point to a couple of things that you think really put Hillary beyond the pale?
Right. I think the first thing, really, is her connection with Saudi Arabia. The fact that there was money that was... We're talking about millions of pounds exchanged. The pay-for-play scandal, which was prominent within certain parts of the media, but then obviously downplayed with others.
Just explain that, pay-for-play. What does that mean?
Pay-for-play, whereby people, prominent world leaders or anyone with a position of power and influence, would actually have to pay Hillary Clinton to come in to the White House to actually have a verbal exchange, and probably then exchange would lead into further agreements, which would actually be the benefit of that. It could be a private organisation or...
It's payment for access. access,
payment
really,
for
isn't
access.
It? And photo opportunity.
And a photo and the PR and all the PR that would come from that. So Hillary was putting herself, she was basically selling the White House, pimping the White House. And that was a concern to the Democratic public. And they didn't want to see, you know, the White House exploited in that way with Hillary's name written, you know, printed all over it. That was not what the White House is set up to be.
But at least she wasn't threatening to nuke North Korea.
I'm afraid that's not actually, she was clearly, she was clearly to nuke. She wanted to start World War III with Russia. And that was very clear and evident in the debate, especially in the last debate where she had it with Trump. She clearly indicated that she was very pro-war and she wanted to eliminate Russia because she saw Russia and kept up that rhetoric right throughout the stage of her campaign, which was a concern to the electorate of America. That was one of the key reasons why Trump was elected and why I was very pro-Trump, was that he said, no foreign entanglements. Let's keep our fingers out of the foreign. Let's not police the world. He said, first and foremost, our country is in a lot of trouble. Let's stick our nose out of other people's business and let's get our own country on track.
Well, that's what he said. And now he's decided it's okay to bomb Syria. But without asking the United Nations Security Council.
Absolutely.
And also without asking Congress.
I know. And this is a real shocker. I mean, to be honest, up until April the 4th, we were all under the illusion that Trump was doing exactly what he was proposing to do under his economic policies, which was bringing jobs back into America. He was doing everything. And then he made a public statement through Tillerson, who basically said there will be no regime change for Assad in Syria, and was fully in support of Assad. But 2 weeks later, we get this event in Syria, which purports to blame Assad for these chemical weapon attacks. And then suddenly we have a change of rhetoric from Trump, which I find phenomenal. He goes about making this statement with no evidence of this chemical weapon attack, that it was actually Assad. We know that there was a chemical weapons attack, we know that. But we don't have evidence that it was actually Assad gassing his own people, which in any term, most critics have actually said this is bonkers. Why would Assad, who's actually holding the cards in negotiations, not only had he had Trump on his side by the 2 week earlier statement. So in other words, Assad knew he had the Americans. And there was back in 2013, we know that the Syrian government had no chemical weapons because they actually the actual exercise of that was an agreement between the Americans and the Syrian government that the Americans would take control, step in to Syria, and actually carry the weapons out. So the Americans knew that he had no chemical weapons to release on his own people. So the prospect of the Assad regime, you know. But, however, we do have other critics. And we have, there's a journalist, for example, called Tom Duggan, who lives in Syria and has done so for the past 4 years. And he's a very good journalist. And he's quite critical of this mainstream media analysis that Assad gassed his own people.
Yeah, but it's not just the mainstream media, it's Trump as well, isn't it? So is he just weak? Or is he being lied to?
What's happened is, if you look at the course of events, Trump, right, has, you know, when he set out to abolish Obamacare, he set that out. He laid the plans, and then, lo and behold, the opposition came on that, and he couldn't get the bill through. So when he realised, actually, he's not up against just the Democrats, he's up against the very Republicans that were fighting against him during his own campaign. He has a majority. He has a majority in both houses, but somehow he can't get his own legislation through because there is fierce opposition and disloyalty within his own party, which, quite frankly, is disgusting given the fact that the American people voted for Trump and these policies, and that these Republicans are actually going against Trump's, you know, clear mandate. But the fact of the matter is, I think, okay, so that was the first hurdle. So he couldn't get that through. And then, of course, now we've got the prospect of the tax reform coming through, and he can't seem to get that through either. Can't even get any form agreement. So I think he feels he's cornered. There's no question about that. And then we had the state...
That didn't take long, did it? I mean, we're talking about 2 or 3 months after brought in as president, he suddenly feels boxed in.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's it. I mean, I think this is something that maybe Trump himself didn't realise that. I mean, Trump is very ballsy. We can see that in the run-up. I thought this is a good candidate for someone who can really stand up against this. But I think he's probably realised his own human frailty, and that actually, if even on his own territory, people are actually boxing him in, you know, the disloyal people, that is going to bring some considerable pressure. And I mean, the other thing is as well, is that Trump himself has, you know, fought this, but I don't think he's really thought his own problems through. But I think
is he a bit out of his depth, do you think? He was maybe went into becoming president thinking, crikey, I'm going to really change things here, and he suddenly realizes that's actually not what the president does. The president is much more someone that stands up and makes speeches on behalf of the real elite behind the scenes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to suggest that Trump wasn't aware, because I think if we look at the narrative in his campaign, it's clear that he was understanding at least the power bases within.
He talked about draining the swamp, didn't he? Then what did he do? Appointed a whole bunch of ex-Goldman Sachs bankers to his cabinet. So he's actually now surrounded by these swamp creatures.
Absolutely. However, initially, I think this is the thing. Trump may have thought, maybe let's try and balance the power about. I think the biggest weakness of Trump, and I've always suspected this from the beginning, is that he thinks everybody can be his friend. And I think he's always tried to appease the aggressor by saying, look, let's just, you know, let's maybe talk about this over a few drinks, like he always has with Hillary Clinton. He's kept his frenemies very close to him.
Like President Xi, he was talking about having a chit-chat about Syria with him over dessert and this kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely.
And if you sit down with someone over a meal, then everything's going to be fine afterwards.
Yeah, he thinks that he has got the remit to, but he doesn't realise how ruthless and endless these people are in the pursuit of him and to destroy him. And I think this is one of his biggest failings. And I think we can see that maybe weeks before the announcement of the Syria attack, we can see how flustered Trump was in office and how he literally gave up on the media and walked out on a few occasions where people kept pressing him about the whole Russia connection. I mean, he's so frustrated with this false narrative that Russia somehow is, and they'll still continue the narrative. And I think it's got to him. Psychologically, I think it's got to him. I think the personal attacks on him with the false allegation that he is with Russia, there's no evidence for that, and yet still flying around in the media. We still have these so-called journalists, these respected journalists, pushing these questions in question time, and it's still escalating it.
Well, we know we had the same thing going on here in Britain. It's a long time ago, probably before your time, but back in the 1970s, there was all the whispers and rumours, articles, printed opinion pieces in some of the national papers here in Britain, that Labour Prime Minister Harold Wilson was actually secretly working for Moscow. This is under, I suppose you would say, more serious, because it was during the Cold War. It was during the time of the Soviet Union. And there were serious people, particularly within the army, the right wing in the army, saying, well, Harold Wilson, our prime minister, is actually a Soviet agent. So this isn't the first time this whole Russia thing has come up as a way to try and bash a prime minister, a president, serious politician over the head.
I mean, if you want to look at it that way, you could actually even go far as to suggest this is a form of blackmail. And maybe if we look at the evidence that was so-called brought up against Trump, we know that there was a false dossier published from the British agents about the golden shower, this mystery golden shower. Now, I don't want to go into the sordid details, but you can probably look that up yourself. But effectively, it was an agent of, I assume, MI6 or either MI5, one of the two.
Supposedly a former MI6
Absolutely.
Agent.
I think it was Christopher Steele.
Yeah, yeah, let's just get it clear here what the term means, because an agent is someone who's working for MI6.
Yes.
An officer is someone who is actually MI6.
Yeah.
So he's someone who MI6 have found and said, oh, this guy could be useful.
So that's what it is. He'll probably have a handler, someone he'll report to, and then he'll furnish the information. We know that he has got these connections, and he had a private company in London that does this business of furthering information on people and passing it over. So we know he's a legitimate person within that circle, but that was handed over to the opposition, like the Obama admin, to further this against Trump. I mean, we only have to look at the source and the credibility of that to know that actually this can't be right anyway. So, you know, I think the fact is...
Fake news.
Fake news. And then the prospect of the fact that it came from the opposition, of this prospect of fake news, is somewhat laughable. But again, you can't really laugh it off completely. It still needs to be taken seriously, because it then has a potential effect on free speech.
Yeah. Also, though, in the run-up to the election, Trump was very down on China. He was saying, well, he thinks that China is not pulling its weight in the world. It's actually using its economic might to beat America. It's which actually is a, you know, some would say a fair fight. You know, it's that's
well, the
what
thing
they
with
do,
Trump was what was so significant about Trump is that he had an in hate knowledge above anybody else on the candidacy for the knowledge that actually China was actually manipulating its own currency. And Trump kept repeating that over and over. It's like he knew exactly the forces that were.
Well, surely the dollar has been manipulated many times over the decades.
Absolutely. I mean, this is it.
They're just playing the Americans at their own game, surely.
Yeah. But what he was saying was on the back of that, it's somehow being allowed, and that China is now growing, which, you know, all credit for China, but at the end of the day, you know, all these American jobs are going overseas, and he's saying, no, we've got to stop this. And one of the things we can do is stop this allowance of the Chinese manipulation of their own currency, or curb it so that we can get back on track. Now, he was the only person, Hillary Clinton, for all the years in office, didn't even touch that subject. He was the only person to bring that up. And I thought, nah, this guy has got some welly. He really does have something to bring to the table. And it's not just about his personality. And so the fact is, but, you know, irrespective of that, what we've seen in the very short time is from the April the 4th is a whole new U-turn on events. Going back...
So this is the decision to bomb Syria. Unilateral decision.
Unilateral decision.
No one can stop us. We're just going to do it.
And the other thing is, he's kicking off with North Korea. But I think what one thing needs to bear in mind is that, you know, the issue with Syria is not just about Syria, it's about Russia. And the fact is, he is now, what he's done with that is taken a formal stance against Russia, and Russia has communicated that and understood that.
Well, they've torn up this agreement, the intelligence sharing agreement for the airspace over Syria, haven't
which
they?
Is not good.
So it might mean that
he's jeopardised Trump talked about a potential alliance with Russia, which would have been pretty fantastic, really, if we could get Russia, you know, on board more dialogue, more communication and more respect in terms of
agreements. Ever since the end of the Cold War, Russia has been floating, if Russia can float, I'm not sure it can, towards China. It was part of the G8 and then it was kicked out of the G8, apparently as part of sanctions. And so they're now actually much more friendly with the Chinese than they ever were. They were always a kind of mediating force between China and the US and Europe. And now they've decided, well, we're saying bye-bye to Europe and America and we're saying hello to the Chinese. So if Trump had been able to make a lot more of an alliance with China, that would have brought the Russians back more into the middle.
Yeah. I mean, but basically, without going off on a tangent, I mean, essentially, Syria to me is there's a few things going on here. First of all, it's basically endorsing the complete Clinton rhetoric. In fact, what's very interesting is 2 weeks before the 4th of April, Clinton, for the first time in many months, actually came forward and had a public interview. And on her interview, she actually said, "We need to bomb Syria," and she gave the details about, you know, X, Y, and Z, and people can look that up. But
was this on off the back of this so-called chemical weapons attack?
Yes. Yeah. But this is 2 weeks before Trump actually came out and said, we need to sort Syria out. And obviously, on the 4th of April, I think it was in the morning or the afternoon, probably in the morning, Hillary Clinton had an interview and spoke live about how there is a pressing need to, you know, get rid of Assad in Syria and to basically remove the elements of or trying to disturb the Russian element within Syria and the hold there. And then 2 hours later, very strangely, we get an announcement from Trump that they're going to be moving in and bombing, they're going to be sending the missiles over. And I thought, that's very strange. So people can look into that. That was a very interesting. So it was almost as if there is a very close relationship now between former Secretary, you know, Hillary Clinton and Trump. So something's gone on.
Or the people around him, the neocons around
Absolutely.
Him.
Absolutely. Yeah. But the other thing that's very interesting is back on what you were saying about draining the swamp. He has brought in this very unusual character called Jared Kushner, who is who's risen to prominence. How he's done this, I don't know. He's a guy who's got no experience whatsoever, but suddenly has now assumed the role, might as well be Secretary of State, for the information he's handling. He's effectively kicked out Steve Bannon, who was formerly, because Steve Bannon didn't like Kushner there. But Kushner...
Well, also Bannon was against this attack on Syria, too.
Absolutely. And when Kushner, who is very pro-Israel state, came up... Now, obviously, Kushner is married to his daughter, Ivanka, and... it's also believed that Kushner was backed by George Soros. I mean, it's not actually believed, it's a fact. George Soros actually backed Jared Kushner in his early startup business.
Now, George, just to refresh, George Soros was one of the people behind Black Wednesday.
He's also a Nazi, effectively. Oh, I mean, he is a Nazi by fact. I mean, we know that from his history and that he came over.
Multi-billionaire. Speculator, currency
he
speculator.
He manipulates the currency. Well, he manipulates the market.
Bilderberger, too.
Bilderberger. Yeah,
all sorts.
So he's not, you know, he's not a good guy, as it were, but he backed Kushner in his startup business, and that's a fact. But the fact is, it could be seen that Kushner was plant there to get to worm into the Trump organization because he's married to his, you know, beloved daughter. The fact is that he is clearly a neocon in his pursuit for the state of Israel. And Israel basically doesn't want Assad. Assad is the only stable regime that is fighting ISIS. And what our newspapers are failing to mention right now is that we should not be destabilizing Syria, because if we remove, it's like we're not learning anything. You know, when we look at our previous history, we created a vacuum within the Middle East, and that gave rise
Libya,
to ISIS.
In Libya and in Iraq, for example.
Yeah.
Anywhere you create a vacuum, these kind of ISIS chaps kind of move in, don't they?
Absolutely, and it gives them free rein.
Want that in Syria?
No.
Come on, folks.
Yeah.
Put your thinking caps
on. So we want Assad is actually a very decent guy, and he's keeping the power control there. And there's no logical reason that he would ever gas his own people, given the fact that he's doing so well with the Americans in terms of their opinion, and he's complied with everything, that suddenly he would, within the short space of time, do a sudden U-turn and gas his own people.
But all this ramping up tension with North Korea is really a pop at China, isn't it? Let's just move away from looking at Russia for a minute.
Yeah.
Tensions are up, coming up with Russia because of the breaking of this agreement in the air in Syria. The prospect of some kind of battle with North Korea is really going to affect China. Now, this is if the Americans and the South Koreans start to move into North Korea, which is feasible if there is a war there, then that actually is a direct threat to China. So we're starting to see a little bit of possible world war.
Well, actually, hang on a minute. I think things have moved on since, I don't know what you lost, but actually Trump has actually gone in there now with the American US troops and the Japanese troops. He's somewhere near North Korea, but he's actually got the troops there already.
In South Korea. This whole business with Korea and China starts to look a little bit like World War III.
Absolutely. And with that, let's not forget, you know, the fact is, irrespective of who's playing the game here, we're looking at the oil pipe that's been requested in Syria, and where Assad said no. So when Assad said no, suddenly we get a lot of military intervention from foreign Western governments,
so
like Britain.
What about oil pipelines in Korea?
Hmm?
What about oil pipelines in Korea?
Well, that's it. Assad has traditionally said no, please don't come into my country, and please don't put a pipe for your oil through, you know, the lines of my country. So with that said, everything, you know, quote unquote legitimate has been tried to, it's interventionist policy on the back of this, you know, illusion of ISIS, or if it's not ISIS, it's Assad gassing his own people.
Okay, so we've got tensions rising with Russia, between the US and Russia, with the EU and Brussels are kind of in the sandwich there. And then we've also got tensions rising in Korea as well, and news as well this week that there's an announcement that the Japanese troops will be going to South Korea, which is almost unbelievable. The Japanese, up until about 2 years ago, they said that after World War II, their troops would never be used outside Japan. Now, it looks like they're going to be threatening the North Koreans for the Americans.
Absolutely.
They talk about Japan as the male glove on the fist of America, you know, so they're doing America's dirty work.
You see, the thing is, let's not forget about the British government here. The British government is fully behind this and have been backing and pushing for Trump to do this for some time. In fact, there was an almost, a wave, a Mexican wave, and then the British government, when Trump renounced this, you know, of like in support of like, let's go in and like ruin the Assad government. Because it's all about regime change, which is effectively Clinton's policy from day one. But, you know, the thing is, I think the now we can see what's coming into effect, and that is World War III. And I think, unfortunately, that is going to be the turn of events, and it's not going to be good news. And I don't think World War III is going to be a quick event. It's going to be a long, arduous.
Now, I know you've taken a step back from all of this, and you think that the First World War, Second World War, were part of a plan, and the Third World War is just simply a kind of, it, rather than these things happening just willy-nilly or without any kind of particular purpose, something happens, a war starts, you think that it's part of a much wider plan?
Absolutely. We have several world leaders who've come up with, anyone who knows anything about war knows that war is not just started, it's been planned for and it's been carefully planned for, and there's a lot of people with a lot of expertise that know about what they're doing and how they can, you know, shift and maneuver things within countries, create revolutions, and effectively affect change.
It's been said for centuries, if you want peace, prepare for war.
This is the irony. But I mean, effectively, there is a very interesting debate going on about the prospect of war, which I think is now more apparent than ever. But I think what's very interesting is there is a chap called Albert Pike, who is a Freemason, effectively, and he is a prominent Freemason within all the lodges.
Well, he's a historical figure, isn't he?
He's a historical figure. He's worshipped and adored by the Freemasons. He's literally plastered in every single lodge, with this picture or some monument of some other. But effectively, why he's so prominent is the fact that it's an agreed consensus that there is a plan within these circles, these secret society circles. They're also known as the Illuminati. Now, people may question about the existence of this, but effectively, we know the Freemasons exist, but they also, some of them, factions of them, refer to themselves as the Illuminati. And obviously, people can look into that. But
well, I mean, it's, you're absolutely right. I mean, if you get your Collins Dictionary out, open that up, you'll find the Illuminati in there. It's a society set up in Bavaria, in Germany, in the late 1700s. I think it's about 1777 even. I don't know. Around about the 1780s, anyhow. Set up by a guy called Adam Weishaupt, who was, first of all, arrested. The society was broken up. But then he was taken into protection by one of the Queen's ancestors, one of the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family, who was the king around those parts in
those
days.
They
definitely existed in those days. Yeah. But what makes you think that there's still some significance today?
Well, I think we only have to look at, I mean, in terms of significance, we know that the Freemasons exist. We don't know exactly what they're talking about behind closed doors, but we do know there is evidence of a letter that Albert Pike wrote to this chap. I believe he was called Mazzini.
Yeah, Giuseppe Mazzini.
Yeah, Mazzini.
And Mazzini, interestingly, was one of the people behind the unification of Italy. So Italy had been a lot of city-states, places Venice, etc., plus the big provinces of Italy. Mazzini was the man who managed to unify it all under one, make it one country. And so he was revered amongst the Masons. He was a Mason himself, definitely. So you've got that bit right. Yeah. But what makes you think that this letter between Albert Pike, who was a Confederate officer in the US Army, and this guy Mazzini over in Italy has got so much significance today?
Right. Well, so first of all, we can look at it historically. So first of all, what he says is that there has to be, in his words, it's alleged that in his letter he wrote, there has to be a World War One which will take effect to overthrow the Tsars and Russia, allow the Illuminati to form a, quote, fortress of atheistic communism, right? And then the divergence will caused by agents of the Illuminati between the British and Germanic empires will be used to foment this war. Now, we do know historically the British and the Germans were the key aspects of World War One, right? So we can look back at that and think, wow, that's a lot of information. And how did that war come about? So anyway, so people can look at that.
The other thing about the First World War, of course, is that there was really achieved absolutely nothing apart from lots and lots of people dying.
Absolutely.
The borders just went straight back to where they were.
The common man really did lose out big time. That was a big, loss of death for the war.
And it was the beginning of the uprising in Ireland as well. So the Irish began to sort of say, well, we're having nothing more to do with this idiotic empire anymore. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So, but the thing is, that didn't stop. I mean, the thing is, the powers that be then went on to create World War II. And what he then goes on to say, again, he says, World War II, Albert Pike refers to World War II, must be fomented by taking advantage of the differences between the fascists and the political Zionists. This war must be brought about so that Nazism is destroyed and that the political Zionism is obviously the reference to the Israeli state, be strong enough to institute a sovereign state of Israel and Palestine? And do we know that actually? Yes, it did.
Well, and also this has been a lot of talk about this with the suspension of Ken Livingstone from the Labour Party, because he was saying that the Nazis actually, and Hitler specifically, he talks about, supported Zionism. Now, he doesn't say, I mean, a lot, he's been misquoted to say Hitler was a Zionist, but it's certainly quite clear if you go back to the 1933 Havara Agreement between the Zionists and the Nazis, that he saw the Zionists as being his little Trojan horse in order to break the Jewish boycott, because there was a massive Jewish boycott of German goods at the time, and the Zionists were prepared to do a deal with Hitler and say, well, actually, if you can provide some safe passage for Jews out of, and Zionist Jews particularly, out of Nazi Germany, we will pay you for it. So he was actually saying, well, this sounds like the kind of people we can do business with.
I mean, the other thing is as well, as point note, that Carl Edward, who was the grandson of Queen Victoria, we know as a decorated military personnel, was also over in Germany. You know, there's pictures of him people can find, sat there having tea with Hitler, discussing what, right? So people can then, and also we know that King Edward himself was a Nazi sympathiser.
Yeah, this is Edward VIII,
yeah, Edward
VIII.
That
abdicated.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right. So he was a Nazi sympathiser. So the fact that, and also you've got to remember that this country very much supported fascism, you know, in its early throngs of World War II. I think people quite conveniently forget that, or
well,
maybe
also,
it's dropped out of history somehow.
Look, some would say we supported fascism at the end of the Second World War because of the deals done between some traitors within the British side and the American side and Nazis for safe passage. So the Nazis desperately needed safe passage. They had their little Catholic Vatican, shouldn't really say Catholic because it was mostly organised through the Vatican, the rat lines that helped them get away.
Yeah.
But then they also had a fantastic amount of wealth that they'd stolen from the whole of Europe. So they were able to do deals with that wealth with traitors amongst the Allies. Also, there's the John Ainsworth Davis, Christopher Crichton is his pen name, book Op JB, which makes a pretty good case for saying, well, actually the money came to Britain in the person of Martin Bormann, Hitler's Reichsfuhrer, the head of the Reich. So he was basically Hitler's number two, and he was whisked straight to Britain with his bank accounts and his checkbooks to all these Swiss vaults and signed various checks for safe passage. So it wasn't just before the war that the Brits were doing deals with the Nazis. It was certainly afterwards too.
Right. Yeah. Well, there we go. And we know that the CIA was set up with lots of, you know, Nazi personnel from the Second World War. A lot of the leading scientists from the Nazi bank moved over to the USA, which is pretty unthinkable.
Well,
we've been fighting them.
And Cold War intelligence agents as well.
Yeah.
Pretty much the whole of the Nazi
that was basically the setup of the CIA. You know, they literally, that there was no CIA really before then. It was an agreement to bring in these, you know, foreign the Nazi top brass, and then basically set it up. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
So how does this all play out today, and do you think we can avoid a third world war?
No, I don't think people can. We only have to look at, I think this is the problem, is first of all, the common man is not going to understand the level of complexity that's in operation to succeed with World War III. There are so many fingers and pies politically to make sure this succeeds. So, and we can see now Trump is fully on board with the neocon rhetoric of let's go, let's do it, and I'll, you know. And I think we have no real way of stopping. And people can make protests in the street, but it won't really make any difference. We only have to look at the protests in the street when when people found out about the so-called weapons of mass destruction that we were led to believe there were by our, you know, Mr. the great Tony Blair, when we know that there was a report to say there was no weapons of mass destruction, but yet we still went to war in Iraq and created this situation, which then led to the vacuum, and then we have the rise of ISIS, coincidentally.
It does. I mean, I think I agree with you that it does. If you step back from it, it does look as if there's a plan and they're just going to do it. They come on the TV with a whole bunch of excuses. Oh, we're doing it because of this, we're doing it because of that.
And I think the trouble is that people just swallow it hook, line, and sinker. They don't question anything. You know, there might be some people that might say, well, actually, I don't want to go to war. But then they'll say, well, actually, there is a legitimate reason why we need, and maybe it's for humanitarian reasons.
Look, each time they do this, surely there's more people questioning, more people scratching their heads saying, hang on a minute, this isn't right.
if there is, we don't see any evidence of it. You know, I mean, if people are thinking to themselves, maybe we shouldn't go to war, but they'll find plenty of others who probably think, let's swallow the media narrative and go in again as if we haven't learnt before of what our own leaders are telling us and that or not telling us or even mistelling us. We know that the dossier by Alistair Campbell was, quote, sexed up. And that was deliberate attempt to, you know, create this narrative for war.
It's a little bit similar to that chemical weapons attack the other week, isn't it? This whole
absolutely.
WMD nonsense.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there's no evidence. And yet we're going in and yet people are pressing, saying we want the investigation before you attack Syria.
Okay,
and Trump saying, no, let's just go and
given
do
you, it. If you can't do anything about it, you must be able to do something, even in your own world, in your own world. Just stay sane.
Well, this is it. Maybe I think if we're going to step into World War III, it's not going to be over. It's not going to be like World War I or World War II. It's going to be mass annihilation.
Some will say it's quite going to be very fast.
No,
lightning.
I do not believe so. I'll tell you why. Let's look at Albert Pike again on his last and final analysis of how we're going to get into World War III. And he's saying this time it will be between the political Zionists, i.e. the Israeli, and the Israeli supporters, which effectively is Britain as well. And we know Trump as well as in all of this.
This is the Christian Zionists as well in the West, isn't it?
Well, I wouldn't use the term Christian, because in this analysis, he's actually saying now this time Christianity will be persecuted. And it's saying that we are going to remove the Christian, and we're going to put in nihilists and atheists, and we're going to put them together. But essentially what he's saying is that how this is going to pan out in the Middle East, it's going to start with the Middle East. He's saying that the Zionists are going to come up, they're going to fight the Islamic world. Now, we know the Islamic world is quite prominent over there at the moment. There are so many more Muslims than the other factions like Assad.
Well, the main one being Iran, really, and
Iran,
Tehran.
Yeah, but like I said, so I think, you know, the main thing is we know that Iran would probably side with Russia and Assad because they have the same sort of leanings. But essentially, what he does go on to say is that when we have created this annihilation between the both sides, we are going to bring in the doctrine, the pure doctrine of Lucifer, to show you why it's so important to follow Lucifer, because you'll say the Christians will be annihilated because of the revolutionary movements we will create against them and encourage people to get rid of Christians because, again, the blame of war will be brought on them. But he says when that comes about, he'll say the only remedy we will offer is the pure doctrine of Lucifer. And it said this time, and the first and only time, it will become so apparent for the first time in the public view that Luciferianism will be so open. So all the symbols of, you know, brought about with Luciferianism and Satanism effectively will become much more open in the public domain, and it will be accepted because it will be seen as the doctrine of preference when all the other sides have been annihilated and they will be brought under this this ideological preference. So
is this letter true? Is it a real letter? I mean, what's the evidence for it?
Well, the thing is, the evidence apparently comes from the sources. Now, the other thing, you can view this letter in its written form on a website called www.threeworldwars.com.
Okay.
And you can look at that, and you can look at the arguments about where it comes from, and you can make your own mind up. But to be honest, I've already made my own mind up. I mean, I'm not going to suggest that people assume that it has to be one way or the other, but you can only draw your own conclusions.
Sonia, that's fascinating. Whether you're right or not, we shall see. Mm. And I'll tell you what, I'll put up a link to the letter and to the Three World Wars website on the show page, which is dialectradio.co.uk. And thanks very much for joining us again here on Dialect.
Okay, there we go.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Kerry Bales from Hartcliffe and Withywood Neighbourhood Partnership and Bristol's Homes for All. Also, Sonia Morn. Is World War III inevitable? I wonder what you make of her reference to Albert Pike's letter warning of three world wars. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also, you can contact us via Volunteering Bristol, 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the national volunteering site, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put the end to war.